Marshall and Sagar here. Welcome back to The Realignment.
If you look at the really transformative politicians, they were not outsiders. They were not amateurs who came in at the age of 60 or 70. Washington had a career in Virginia colonial politics. So Lincoln was a career politician. He practiced law. FDR, career politician, more or less.
This week, we are very excited to welcome back friend of the show, Michael Lind. He's professor at the University of Texas. More importantly, he is the author of New Class War, which I would classify as one of the guiding North Stars of this podcast. He famously, or at least I've tried to make it famous, made the point that there is no winning the culture war. There is only compromise. It's something that we go into a lot in this episode.
We recorded this episode immediately after Joe Biden's inaugural address. And as we're recording this now, he officially entered the White House for the first time. So we're treating this as a reset of sorts on the show. The number one bit of feedback we got from everyone after our Eric Weinstein episode last week was we appreciated how much Eric helped us think about the moment we're living in. He helped you think about the Capitol Hill riot, the debates about the culture, COVID. So we decided to follow up with Mike because Mike's framework of democratic pluralism, which we'll get into, is exactly the sort of idea for how all of us need to think about our politics moving forward, regardless of what happens over the next 4 years.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So before we get into that, do us all a favor. As we said, sign up for therealignment.substack.com. Special treat for all of you once we hit 1,500. As I said, we're hovering around the 1,000 number. Love that. But, you know, we'll put a little pep in my step. Every single time we get an email saying that one of you have signed up, do us a favor. It's going to hit your inbox every Friday. It comes with transcripts. It comes with listener feedback. Got a lot of great questions, listener feedback, reactions to the inauguration, and more that we want to share with all of you. And you can actually comment in the comment section. So it's just an awesome way for you guys to interact with each other and with the show.
And the perfect thing about our Substack is it includes a link to our bookshop.org shop, which is particularly relevant for all of you because Michael Lind has published over 16 different books, including famously a 350-page epic poem about the Alamo. Whoever does pick that up, please give us a summary. I've heard about it. I've never actually seen it, so I'm sure there's something there. But Bookshop, if you purchase it through the link in the Substack or at the bottom in our show notes, we get 10%. And most importantly for our conversation today, you help support a local bookseller. Incredibly important to do right now.
And I know we're throwing a lot here at you, but we got to mention it. We are beginning to grow on YouTube, which is actually really exciting. We've got like 11,000 subscribers, especially after our latest Eric Weinstein episode. Our channel is just called The Realignment. It's awesome. I mean, I remember what it was like when we were at this nascent stage of growth whenever we were working over at Rising. It's just so exciting. So if you're somebody who likes to watch these episodes or you like, you know, YouTube Premium or something like that, want to switch back and forth, that's an awesome opportunity for you. Just go ahead and hit subscribe. Subscribe at The Realignment's YouTube channel. Really appreciate it if you do so.
And on to our favorite part of the episode, our Q&A section. Now, as you saw in the show title and description, we are doing an extended Q&A session, both because A, we received a huge number of questions that we could not possibly answer in one show at a time after our Eric Weinstein episode, and because this is the second day of the Joe Biden administration, as you're listening to this, we wanted to answer and provide as much clarity and focus as you are looking for. A reminder, here's how you get your question answered on air. You can send us a 5-star review of the podcast to a screenshot thereof to realignmentpod@gmail.com, or you could leave your question in the actual review itself.
Okay, let's get to the Q&A.
Today's first question is from Adam Driver 87. Now, for everyone who's listening, we had an intense debate about whether this is the Adam Driver of girls and Star Wars fame. It almost certainly isn't, but if it is you, Adam Driver, and you're in Brooklyn, please let us know. We'd love to have you on the podcast. But here's this question. Who/what is a millennial conservative? Hi, Marshall and Sagar. Love the podcast and your take on current events. I'm an urban millennial liberal. I get all my news from YouTube and podcasts and avoid the corporate media the best I can. The two of you are the only conservatives I find reasonable, and I find myself agreeing with you on a lot of things. I have a pretty good idea, I think, of what you are not, either Trump or Bush conservatives, and not exactly Tea Party libertarians. So what does it mean to you to be conservative? What are your conservative ideals? What policies do you or would you champion? If you had a magic wand, what would you change about our government / country to make it a better place?
That's a great question, Adam Driver. Hopefully the real Adam Driver. Like we said, Adam, please come on the podcast. And if any of you know Adam Driver, tell him to come on The Realignment. So look, I answered this question. Actually, I really recommend you go back and listen to my episode with Andrew Yang, the crossover episode that we did, because he asked me the same thing. He's like, look, man, I feel like we have a lot in common. Like, I don't really understand like what it is. And for me, what it is it's all about orientation of policy. And I think that all policy should be oriented around helping people have kids, helping people stay in their homes, helping people retain their family units wherever they want to be, and to live a moderately successful life if they choose. I think that's the overall orienting part of my policy. And here's the reason I'm not saying this is why I am a conservative, because that is my guiding principle. And whoever does that, I think, is somebody that I would support. It could be a liberal who supported that. And as long as, you know, I didn't think they were supporting something that were to go against it, I would go ahead, vote for, and support that. So I don't like to think of it in conservative or liberal terms. I'm just giving you what my orientation towards that framework is, and that's just how I look at it. What about you, Marshall?
Yeah, my favorite part of a general theme to our episodes recently, whether it's my discussion with Jennifer Harris about replacing neoliberalism, whether it's last week's episode of Eric Weinstein, or even today's episode of Michael Lind, is the idea that the phrases and the frameworks that we try applying to our politics today no longer make any sense. So I think this would be the point that you and I, Sagar, just reject the idea that this is the conservative podcast,
yeah,
or the populist right podcast, or the neoconservative podcast, or even the center-left podcast or the centrist podcast, because none of these terms mean anything. Because, for example, I listened to your episode of Andrew, obviously, and when you're talking about, I'm a conservative and that's why I want to support families, well, there are plenty of conservatives who don't want things like UBI, mm-hmm, or don't want to exactly increase the child tax credit the same way Joe Biden does. So our response in that situation isn't to say, okay, well, if I like UBI, that means I'm a Democrat, or if I don't like UBI, that means I'm a Republican. It's just to say that we should not be obsessed with labeling ourselves in a moment of realignment where none of this makes any sense. My favorite quote from the Eric episode on this was just, you have to ask for something that's off the menu because the ones you're going to see don't apply.
I love that. You know, you just mentioned one of those, child tax credit. That's something that I really support. Guess who just proposed one of the largest child tax credit expansions in modern history? Joe Biden. So does that make me a Biden supporter? No, not necessarily. It means there's a policy that I really support that Joe Biden is putting forward. Is it conservative policy? I don't really give a shit, is the honest. I just want it to happen. I think that is a way that we should all use to look at politics. Next question. America's identity is the person. I lean center left. I really enjoy this podcast and The Hill because of your premise that Americans seem truly divided. Most of us want similar populist things. Lately, I've started to doubt if this is actually true. Given the inaccuracy of the polls, the apparently strong influence culture had in the last election, the ability of flat-out lies to mobilize citizens to literally attack fundamental parts of our democracy, what real evidence is there that this premise is more than just wishful thinking? Can ballot initiatives like ranked choice and open primary still save us? Or is our government in a death spiral similar to the one that predicted for climate change? Thank you, Chris. What do you think, Marshall?
So we actually gave Chris his actual name. It is unfortunately not actually America's identity. But that's a good question, Chris. And I appreciate it because it shows you're reading between the lines here. If there's one thing that's pretty clear after the last election and frankly the last 4 years, there is no populist consensus in this country. I would argue there's a consensus that people don't think our institutions work. There is consensus that both political parties are dissatisfactory, but there's no consensus, though, that we should advance a unified front. And as I'm thinking back to the pre-pandemic January, February idea that people were hopped up on, and you're referring to your question, was the idea that we'd see much more of Josh Hawley and Bernie Sanders working together on stimulus checks. That was one specific instance, but the broader thing that a lot of people thought we were going to see was a broader populist front along all of those lines. And it's just very clear that that isn't going to happen because of the simple fact that in this specific moment, something Sagar and I are going to hit is that if you are participating in the system actively right now, the culture wars and the election and stop the steal versus Russiagate is going to encourage you to lean as hard as you can into your tribe. And it turns out that members of the tribe who will turn out for you are often have no interest in any form of economic populism.
Yeah, that's perfectly well said, which is, hey, turns out in a low turnout democracy, particularly in a primary system, which is extremely low turnout and which appeals only to the most hardcore parts of your base, you're basically going to have a system where the culture war rules everything. And this is both left and right. All policy is subordinate to the culture war. So what does that mean for the future? What did Eric say? I love this part of our episode where we were like, hey, Eric, what should somebody who's young and who wants to change politics do right now? He's like, just don't do. He's like, your time is not now. It will come. Do not engage in the current fights because it's just simply not useful. And I could not tell you how much I agree with that currently.
And the key thing here is that we're not trying to make everything seem apathetic when we say don't engage. So look,
yeah,
be an activist. Go vote, participate in the system, but there's two different versions of participating in the system. Not to name any names, you know who I'm talking about. Participating in the system is not getting elected and then tweeting about owning libs the first chance you get. You now are not going to accomplish anything in that system. You are a person who was subsumed in every single terrible culture war we're in right now. So if you are going to decide to run for office, if you are going to decide to be an activist, you need, frankly, from my perspective, to focus more locally. You need to focus more on issues that actually matter. And you should take a step back and ask yourself whether or not you're trying to get famous or whether you actually want to make a difference in people's lives. Next 100%. Question. Joey B writes, the podcast has become a staple of my weekly pod queue, always relevant, insightful commentary. I'm not a conservative or Republican, but as an independent, I find this content of value for anyone, regardless of party affiliation or ideology. So here's my actual question. Can you touch on the concept that, quote, foreign policy is domestic policy? And can you discuss the potential trajectories of U.S. foreign policy under a Biden administration, specifically as regards towards our posture in China and the Middle East?
That's a great question, Joey. It's actually something I've thought a lot about. I think foreign policy is domestic policy. What it really means is that our posture abroad is reflective of the posture that we decide here in our democracy in order to project. And one of the more pernicious things that's happened, I would say, over the last 30 years is that our posture abroad has become permanent, and so permanent that it has its own bureaucracy, the people who work within it, the people who perpetuate it, and who don't actually care about how reflective it is of the democratic process. Afghanistan would be the perfect example of that, as well as a few other things. How Biden is going to approach it, I simply have no idea. Biden, at many points in his career, has actually been really good on this. If you go and you think back to some of the debates that were had in Afghanistan on the Afghanistan question back in 2009, Biden was one of the original people who was advocating for not having a surge, for having a light footprint, counterterrorism, telling Obama, do not do this, it could cost you re-election. Now, he's also been somebody who was on board with Libya. In general, I would say he doesn't necessarily have like an overarching framework. But on China specifically, I want to say this because I want to give credit where it is due. I've been highly critical of Biden, how he might approach China and more, and I'm still deeply skeptical. Here's the truth. Jake Sullivan, the incoming national security advisor, recently wrote a foreign policy piece saying neoliberalism is dead and it's not coming back. Even more so, he said that we cannot continue to conduct our policies with China as to what is good for Goldman Sachs while letting people on Main Street suffer. So look, he's saying the right thing. Is it going to manifest itself in the current policy? I cannot tell you that. But that is how I would answer both what your question means and how it's going to reflect itself in the future. What do you think, Marshall?
Yeah, I'll answer the question a little differently. I get your point about the separation of the foreign policy apparatus in DC from the domestic concerns, but I would also think about the framework by which even people on the domestic level think about foreign policy decisions. Think back to something we talk about all the time, China's entry into the World Trade Organization in 2000. When we had that debate about the World Trade Organization, many people would say things like, we are doing this thing because of X, Y, and Z foreign policy decision. We are doing this thing because we think China needs to be let into the world system, because we've had a successful China policy since Nixon went to China in the 1970s, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The thing that did not happen in that conversation, however, there was not a strong enough discussion about the impact of China's ascension on the domestic level issue. So as we're thinking about all these things moving forward, because we no longer live in the 1990s where we could take a chiller back to those sort of questions, everyone is going to have to see the ties between all those issues. And then on Biden, I am cautiously optimistic on the China questions. As Sagar said, the reality is that if President Trump has one single success that will actually matter for history, it's the fact that he was able to bludgeon ourselves into a stronger posture towards China to the point where the bipartisan consensus has completely switched on that issue from the Obama-Bush year. At the same time, though, the area I'm most concerned about is Russia. Obviously, Russia has a bunch of hugely strategic, hugely important problems with the U.S. right now. Obviously, Russia is an imperialistic power. Vladimir Putin is a bad person. All of those statements. That being said, I am not quite certain that a declining power where the literal life expectancy is collapsing, there's this good quote where Russia is referred to as a gas station with nuclear weapons. They're not a developed state. I would not want a situation where they over-index on the short-term threat of Russia against the long-term issue of China, because every single incentive, especially when it comes from the media, is for the Biden administration to hyper-focus on Russia and then say something like, well, Trump handled Russia badly, so we're hawkish there, reward us. And he handled China badly, so we're going to be peaceful and let them back in and just say bygones be bygones.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, man, because I'm really concerned about it, too. You know, I just saw Hillary Clinton, you know, have Pelosi on her podcast, and she's like, we need a 9/11 style commission to see if there's ties between Trump and Putin and whether he talked to Putin on the day of the Capitol riots. I'm like, isn't the riots enough? Like, can't we just leave it at the riots? Like, well, why did we have to add some sort of Putin situation here? And it's like you said, look, fuck Russia. I'm not a Russia defender. Putin is a bad guy. He just threw Navalny in jail. Like, I'm not somebody who's like a defender of Putin. I'm like, oh, there's nothing wrong with Putin. But like you said, this is a dying petrostate. Yeah, they have nukes. But by and large, they're like a useless nation that largely has a footprint only because of the legacy from 35 to 40 years ago, and orienting your entire global economic and foreign policy around confronting that when the number two, number one GDP economy in the world actively is trying to infiltrate your markets, destroy your productive capacity, and is certain to be on the scene for the next 40 years, that's completely insane. And that is, like you said, my biggest worry that we are going to see under the Biden administration, because the Russia phobia, or whatever you want to call it, runs deep. And I'm not saying it isn't warranted. I'm not saying that these people are good. But this is a situation where some realpolitik is absolutely called for.
That's the key thing, because what we're trying to get everyone to understand here is Russia is a threat. China is a threat. The concern would just be that the Biden administration would say, we're going to do the opposite of every single thing that Trump did. And we're going to say that Russia is the long-term competitor. China is our friend. In many ways, Trump went too easy on Russia. You can't have the opposite situation happen. Next question.
Okay, next question. This is from Dodd something. Makes me think. Love the podcast for its striving to engage in thoughtful discussions. In this world where I don't know which sources to trust, this is one of the places where I turn to gather information. I appreciate the tone and demeanor of the hosts as well. Question, which era in our country's history is the present time similar to comes from the school of thought that nothing is new under the sun? What do you think, Marshall?
This is a great question because it's something we've all been thinking about. A year or two ago, I would have given one generic answer, which would have been, this is just like the progressive era where wrestling with big tech and the power of trust and all these different dynamics. But I think we're in a weird position where understanding this moment, and we're definitely going to do many more episodes about history this season, requires understanding that there's a bunch of different eras. So era number one, I completely buy into the roaring 20s framework, especially if the vaccine distribution, et cetera, goes well over the next few years, in the sense that if when the economy reopens, if 2021 or early 22 go well, we're going to reopen to a economic boom, most likely, which will create a situation where a country which has gone through a horrific pandemic will have a lot of openness. Andrew Sullivan does his whole, like, it's going to be debaucherous take that is always really funny. It's not untrue. At the same time, though, we do have the bit of this, as I mentioned before, that is very, it's the year 1910. There's the power of tech companies. We don't quite have the language or the legal frameworks to approach this question. The Republican Party is having this debate between centrism and more traditional conservatism. What's up for grabs on the left is also up for debate there too. And the last bit I'd add is there really is something, we talked about this with Joe Scarborough, that's very much like our post-1945 World War II moment, where the previous order that undergirded the way we organized our lives, aka the colonial system pre-World War II, doesn't really work anymore. And for us, we've had 70 years of the post-World War II system where everything makes a lot of sense. People trust international institutions. But after China and Trump, after the WHO lost a lot of trust with people, we know for a fact, regardless of whether you supported Trump or not, there's no way we're going to wake up in 1992 all over again.
Yeah, it's a great question. I basically think we are living simultaneously in like 1905, 1914, and in 1921. So 1905, it's exactly what you said. We have the economic concentration problem, the monopoly problem, many of the questions that we confronted pre-World War I around distribution in our economy, worker power, democratization of money, etc. So all of that bucket, the economic problems, there. Then, like you just referred to, on a global scale, we are completely realigning in terms of our priorities as a country, foreign policy, what the global world order is going to look like. Are we transitioning to more of a balance of power, bipolar international system with the rise of China? So what I mean by that is 1914 was, of course, the year that World War I broke out, the Guns of August, and all of that. There will be some precipitating event that is going to happen within the next 10 years, which is going to radically change the post-World War II global order. I don't know what that is. It could be war in Taiwan. It could be North Korea. That's something that I thought a lot about back in 2017. It could be something maybe that happens in Europe. I have no clue. I think it'll probably come out of Asia if I had to guess, but something is going to happen. So that's the 1914 side. And then at the same time, like you said, 1921, that's the first year that we were fully out of the Spanish flu, the global pandemic, and it's going to be gangbusters. And honestly, that's the part I'm looking forward to the most. I'm thinking about throwing a 1920s, roaring 20s party whenever this thing is all over, put on the suits, flappers, all of that, because look, it led to the Great Depression and a lot of Wall Street speculation, and we definitely paid for it dearly with the rise of fascism, World War II, and all that. But it was pretty awesome to live through, from what I've read. So it's somewhere in a mix of all that. In other words, tumultuous times. I think what you were trying to quote was that great Mark Twain one, which is that history does not repeat itself, but it rhymes, which is why I was trying to give you some rhyming answers. Okay, next question.
Yes. So here is a combination question because they address the same topic. What's the strategy for consuming more content / reading more books? I want to be a more informed citizen, but there's just so much to shift through. And then this question is from the actual email, realignmentpod@gmail.com, from Brooks. Thank you for all the work you do on the podcast and newsletters. I learned a lot from you both and always look forward to your book recommendations. When reading the last newsletter from January 15th, though, there was a link regarding the books you two have read this year. I counted at the time of this email, 1/19/21, 14 books. What are your methods and habits for reading books at that speed? 14 books read between the two of you around 2 or 3 weeks is an impressive skill in this day of age, Trying my best to keep up and get back into the habit. Quick addendum that we should add, complete confession, 3 or 4 of those books are from the last week of 2019. Sorry, are from the last week of 2020. So we have not literally read that many, but we've done 11 between the two of us. Let's get into strategy and how we're thinking about that, Sagar.
Yeah, I think I started some of them and then finished them in 2021. But look, here is the strategy. Audiobooks. And what else? Audiobooks at speed. Been listening to these things for so long that my mind actually doesn't mind listening at 2 or maybe 2.5 times speed. And the second thing is read several books at once. There are some books I read which are kind of dry and boring. I only take 1 or 2 hours of those. And then I'll switch it up and I'll listen to something that's a little bit more exciting. And then I basically always have like 3 or 4 different books that I'm listening to. So it's a real easy way in order to cram as much information as possible into your head. And it's really entertaining. Honestly, it's a great way for me to keep up to speed, to constantly challenge my thinking. Sometimes I read 2 different books about the same thing at the same time in order to see how 2 different people are talking about the exact same subject. So this is something that him and I have honed very well over the last couple of years. That's my recommendation. Anything, any other notes, Marshall?
Yeah, so here's what I would add to this. A couple of things. One, this is an obvious plug to check out our bookshop.org link. It's in the show notes, in the newsletter. Definitely go there for all of your book shopping. What's really cool about this is even if you go to our page and you are totally uninterested in anything we have to offer, if you still go on the site and purchase something, we still get a commission there. So we really appreciate it. A couple of you all have done that with some really honestly niche choices. I appreciate that. But on to how you actually do this. So 2 things to build on Sagar's point. Let's talk about the mechanics of this. The best advice I got on this was on Twitter during the heaviest part of the pandemic, because I struggle to read books and I'm getting better at it versus listening. Just read 25 to 50 pages a day. If you just sit down and read 25 to 50 pages a day, you are basically going to be able to read 1 book a week. If you combine that with listening to an audiobook, especially one that's less than 10 hours, you could conceivably do 1 book a week and 1 audible book a week. And if you're going at that rate, you're going to pick up so much knowledge. It's going to be incredibly useful. And it just makes it so easy to just be a deep generalist. That's something that Sagar and I are getting more and more interested in, especially as we expand the podcast. If you look at our book list, there's books about Hollywood and the movies and American Buffalo. And that's what makes us actually put together a good show here, because if we're not just a single track partisan-y show, we just won't be as interesting for all of you.
Yeah, couldn't recommend it enough. Always read stuff that is completely outside of your comfort zone. You never know what you're going to learn. I recently read a book recommended to me by Marshall about the rise of the contemporary art market. Honestly, one of the most interesting books I have read in such a long time. All right, last question here. Journalism is being saved by Sagar and Marshall. Thank you, sir. Love this podcast. I've been a huge fan of Sagar since watching Rising. Love hearing Marshall's take when he would appear on the show. So this podcast was a dream come true. My question for you guys. I have my bachelor's and master's in journalism. Sometimes I'll sit and edit the monologues of CNN or Fox or even my local news channel, and I'll seize up with anger because they had submitted that prose to my professor in college or grad school. They would have gotten a big fat F. I regret studying journalism in my undergrad grad programs, and I've opted out of pursuing a career in it because I can't get myself to work for these corporations who care more about viewership than their reporting. Not to mention there are no jobs. What do you 2 think it will take to get to the entertainment aspect out of reporting the news? Or are we doomed to this type of exploitive partisan-based media system? What do you think, Marshall?
Well, as a former PBS researcher, I must first take a step back and defend the good folks who are writing monologues for people on TV and are stressed and are producing. If you're the funny thing, if anyone is, and there's definitely some producers who listen, everyone here knows that when you're actually writing as a producer for any sort of show, your objective is genuinely not prose. You're sitting there, it's crazy, it's hectic, it's super fun. If any of you ever have an opportunity to work in TV news, legacy media or not, I recommend it. It will be an incredible opportunity, but gotta defend my folks. But to the broader question, I wanna just push back against something real quick. And it's something we hear a lot about. And it's something I wish I'd pushed harder on Eric with last week. It is just not true that entertainment, superficiality, partisanship are features just of the legacy media. Something that really concerns me is that we have this huge opportunity to build new podcasts, to build new newsletters, develop this broader new ecosystem to replace the legacy of the 20th century that we have right now. But what's happening right now, especially given the way that the whole appeal to your niche audience, the way that algorithm works, if we're seeing this whole echo chamber emerge on the podcasting and newsletter right and left, it's not a partisan thing. So I would just say that it's totally fair to say that Fox News and MSNBC, especially their opinion sections, are not the places anyone should go to find a nice, calming, smart take. But I also want to say there's plenty of YouTube and plenty of podcasting, which is a dumpster fire, and frankly is even worse because unlike legacy news organizations, there are no fact-checking. Say what you want about PBS, but whenever we put a fact in the show, we had to have three different citations per fact for legal reasons. That's definitely not something that's happening in a lot of the new media. So that's what I would think about that.
Yeah, it's a good question. And that's the thing is, which is that I would say just because legacy media is bad does not mean that the alternative cannot be also as bad. It can also be really good. In many cases, I think that we do a better job of them in a lot of cases. However, what I would say is you don't need to be so down, man. We never lived in a better time in order to get your view out there and actually in order to do journalism the way that you want to do it. As long as there's a market for it, as long as you find a way in order to do it differently, podcast, newsletter, you can go out there and you can make it happen. As long as you have maybe like what, $10 or something, some gas money in order to go out, interview some people, you can write it up, put it on Substack for free, have a Twitter account. You can reach out to me. You can reach out to a lot of different people. And if it's good, look, I've given a lot of people a shot who I've never even met before, who I had no idea who the hell they were. They, you know, have some random YouTube channel or whatever. I'll give anybody a shot. I think there are a lot of people like that who are in the independent media space. So I would say, which is that, don't give up. There's actually never been a better time in order to do something different. And now is the time.
Yeah, and I want to do a quick shout out to Seth Lockman, who is on Twitter. This is the perfect example of this. So Seth has less than 100 followers. What he started doing is he started tweeting out all of the references in our show. He started basically building the show notes that Sagar and I should do if we weren't, frankly, overscheduled. And guess what? Every single time he does that, we're retweeting it. He just launched a new Substack, which you guys should all sign up for. So there's a million things that you could do on the internet to build yourself in a little bit and develop something new. So the key thing here is that also, if we're factoring the reality that everyone is using Zoom right now to record things, the gap between legacy media and independent media and someone like you on your iPhone is the smallest it ever has been and probably ever will be. So definitely this is the year to get chugging at it.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. All right, hope you guys enjoyed that extended question and answer. Let's get to this interview with Michael. As always, a special thank you to the Lincoln Network for sponsoring the work on this podcast. We really appreciate it. Let's dive in.
Michael Lind, welcome back to The Realignment.
Thanks for having me again.
Good to see you, Michael.
It's been a year since we had you on the show. We spoke about your book, The New Class War, a month before lockdowns, coronavirus. So the first question before we get into Joe Biden is basically going to be, how has or hasn't the development in the U.S. and the world over the course of the last year either confirmed or refuted ideas in your book, both looking at the left and the right?
Well, in my book, The New Class War, I argue that our politics is now polarized not so much between left and right, but between insiders and outsiders. In the inside culture, I call technocratic neoliberalism. And I think the response of progressives and many centrists to COVID-19 by idealizing scientists like Dr. Fauci sort of illustrates this culture that the experts know best. Right, that the ignorant masses need to be kept at a distance. Also, the cult of personality around Ruth Bader Ginsburg illustrates the preference of a lot of technocratic neoliberals for policy to be done by authorities that are insulated to some degree from the voters, whether it's administrators or international agencies, or in this case, the federal judiciary. At the same time, in the new class war, I'm very critical of what I call demagogic populism, illustrated in different ways by Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders. And my argument is that while this can channel legitimate grievances against the establishment, in practice, demagogic populism, which has a long history in the American South, in Latin America, even in cities in the Northeast, tends to fizzle out. In a cult of personality around the mayor or the governor, or in this case, around President Trump.
Yeah, I remember you saying that in January, and I guess it was more taboo in order for people like us to say something like that. And it's obviously all borne out, Michael, exactly as you predicted. You were like, yeah, you know, most populists are charlatans in the history of American politics. And, you know, Trump's very last act as president was pardoning Jeanine Pirro's husband of tax fraud. So, you know, I mean, I can't help but think that that was the perfect thesis. Here's something I've really, actually, let's start with the Biden speech. We were talking right before the episode. The name of this podcast is The Realignment. Is this a realignment in American politics? Is it a restoration? I was watching Biden's speech and look, there's nothing to quibble with there. He's like, I'll be a president for all Americans. It's about as humdrum cookie cutter of a speech. I'm not criticizing it. I think that's why 80 million people voted for him. What do you make of that speech, the tenor, and its context within, I've seen you call it the five crises of the American regime. What is that going to do for our politics in the moment that we're in right now?
Well, I wish the best for the new president and the government. And I hope our leaders can find lots of areas of consensus. But just as an analyst, I suspect that in particular, the anti-Trump coalition peaked today. Mm-hmm. It will start disintegrating immediately.
Yeah,
because for 4 years, you've had this incredible omnibus coalition of almost all of the power centers in American society, you know, of militant neoconservatives, libertarians in some cases, radical leftists, progressives, you know, establishment third way neoliberals. And they all agreed that we have to put aside our differences and get Donald Trump out of office. Well, he's gone now. So I think it's nothing but downhill for that coalition as the deep fissures within it become evident. And I think much of the elite hopes this is a restoration. That is, you know, it will be like a retconned TV show where it turns out the last few seasons were just a dream. And, you know, we're going to go back and write a different plot, you know, starting in 2016. But the country has changed and the world has changed and the party coalitions have changed. Biden was pushed by the Democratic establishment in part in the hope that he would win back a lot of so-called Reagan Democrats or maybe Trump Democrats. But in fact, he did best with college-educated affluent whites who are moving right into the Democratic Party. And the Democrats, as you know, lost substantial numbers of African-American, Hispanic, and Asian-American voters. So even though they still get the majority of the non-white vote. So those who hope for a restoration, I think instead we're just at a midpoint in an ongoing partisan and policy realignment.
Mm-hmm. So this is something I've been toying over in my mind, Michael. I'd love to have your thoughts on, which is that I'm generally of the mind currently that this was probably the high water mark for any sort of Trumpian nationalism. And the reason I say that is it seems increasingly clear to me that there are two irreconcilable parts of the current Republican coalition. I'm not saying it can't change, but I'm just saying for the iteration that we saw, you have this kind of QAnon wing of the party, which is also, you know, compiled with a lot of working class voters who are there for Trump specifically, not there for Mitt Romney, Paul Ryan, Mitch McConnell, tax cuts. But Liz Cheney, Mitt Romney, and McConnell do embody maybe, let's say, like 15 to 25% of the party. And it just seems increasingly, and you could see this in the impeachment battle lines of like Liz Cheney and Mitt Romney, Adam Kissinger, those types of people being incredibly, basically to the point where I don't know if they can for the longer exist in the same literal political vehicle of the Republican Party. And the way that I really saw this self-manifest was in Georgia, right? Was Georgia basically made it so somebody like David Perdue or Kelly Loeffler was basically, they were screwed either way. If they embrace Trump's Stop the Steal, then they lose their base. But if they, you know, continue to indulge it, which they did, they lost those suburban Republican voters who were basically like, screw this, I'm out. Maybe not out forever, but I'm out for right now. How do you see that current coalition of the Republican Party? Am I being, you know, too bearish? Are you more optimistic? And how do you see things changing in that regard?
Well, I wouldn't characterize it as optimism or pessimism. I'd try to be objective, but I think that the Republican Party is in good shape electorally. They did much better than expected in races across the country, you know, in last year's election. They're picking up slowly but surely a lot of working class non-white voters, which they need if they're going to lose college educated whites. As long as the Democratic Party repels enough voters, then the Republican Party will win elections to block the Democrats. It's not a dynamic thing. It's just that they're basically seen by voters as a roadblock to stop something they think is worse. But if you think the Democrats will alienate substantial groups of voters, then that can translate into Republican votes.
Right.
On the other hand, I think I agree with you. There is no, even though they can win elections, the Republicans, as of now, cannot govern. They have no governing philosophy, right? You know, the what you call the QAnon right, but it was the Buchanan right.
It was always the new right.
You know, there are like five or six hot button issues at any given time. You know, guns and abortion and so on. And those may be legitimate issues, but they're basically symbolic and tribal, and they're not attached to any philosophy of political economy or foreign relations or jurisprudence or any kind of coherent viewpoint. The declining establishment wing of the Republican Party has what I call self-libertarianism. Mm-hmm. That is, it's libertarianism, and then you wave some flags during the election, but essentially it's the Libertarian Party, and that's going nowhere. You see a lot of the same voters who vote for Republicans in the states also vote for minimum wage increases and so on. So we're in this weird situation where, unfortunately, because you want to have two dynamic parties, the Democrats are the dominant party by default when it comes to actual policy. The policy disputes that matter are within the Democratic coalition, yes, between the neoliberal Democrats like Biden and the Clintons and Obama, and the progressives to their left. And at this point, the Republicans can win, and they can win back the House maybe and the Senate, and they can have a trifecta maybe in 2024. But they're essentially reactive.
You said something earlier that I want to dig into, specifically relating to realignments. You said a political realignment and a policy realignment, because there's a distinction there that matters not just in terms of the show's branding, but actually as you conceive about whether or not the Republican Party could be dynamic. From my perspective and my interpretation of your work is that a huge part of America's political realignment has to do around class and education. It's not necessarily tied to race in the same way that previous ones were. And as it's tied much more to, as your Biden vote is tied to whether you would attended college or graduate school or not, that is going to lead to a bunch of opportunities for people on the right, both demagogic and otherwise, to focus on the discourse about elites, to focus on, that's why you saw a lot of people focusing on the small businesses closing, etc. That's the political version. But there's also a policy version, which is Republicans should win over the pan-ethnic working class through promoting the minimum wages in certain cases, etc., etc., etc. My concern is that the Republican establishment will discover, and this is already happening in media circles, that you can affect a political realignment by focusing on Stop the Steal, a higher IQ version thereof. You can focus on the it's terrible that they've locked us down and we should just not do that without having an actual alternative plan there. How do you think of and separate the policy and the political, and how do we get out of that way? Because I just don't want a world where the right discovers they could talk about how it sucks that the Democratic Party is full of all the Harvard Law graduates, while also at the same time winking and giving the same people salt tax repeals and the actual tax cuts that were happening in 2017.
Well, I think at some point, a policy of realignment will catch up with the partisan realignment within the Republicans. It takes some time. It took a generation or so in the Democratic Party. By about 2000, you were already seeing the Democrats were becoming the Alf Landon Republicans, you know, of the mid-20th century, or the Wendell Willkie Republicans. They were internationalists, free traders, based in New England and in the areas settled by New England on the, you know, they lost their traditional base of farmers and labor. But you still had these Democrats, and there are a few living fossils. I admire him, but he's a relic, a Sherrod Brown in Ohio, you know, praising FDR and Truman and farm subsidies, you know, and the labor, the steel unions. And there's just no one. And finally, the Democrats looked around and there weren't any farmers and there weren't any steel workers, you know, in the whole auditorium. So they kind of, you know, they have realigned. They are now the party of offshoring, of free trade, of low-wage immigration. Those were the country club Republicans, you know, 30, 40 years ago. The Republicans now, if you look at their base, they are the Roosevelt Democrats. Their core is white Southerners and so-called white ethnics, particularly Catholic Euro-Americans, but you know, more and more African-Americans, particularly working class, and Hispanic Americans, but they have this Chamber of Commerce, Cato Institute libertarian elite, intellectual and policy elite, which honestly is just in the wrong party. I looked the other day at the education statistics. All the way up until the late 20th century, the Republicans got the college educated people who are now Democrats. FDR, now this is amusing. He did very well among high school graduates, and he just, you know, he did best among people whose education did not extend beyond sixth grade. he got that K through six vote.
Yes,
right. He never.
Which was
got,
huge bet. Which was, you
yeah,
think
was,
about
by
it,
way,
it,
that was huge.
Yeah. So he never ever got the Ivy League vote, you know, or even the small town, you know, college votes. So how will this come about? I think realignments come about ultimately as a matter of calculation by politicians. And right now, I think a lot of Republican politicians are afraid that if they anger the Club for Growth or these other libertarian donors, then they will be taken out, you know, in the next election. But at the end of the day, elections are determined by warm bodies and voting booths. Mm-hmm. And if you get more and more Republicans who can survive attacks by libertarian donors, then they're going to look like a paper tiger, I think, eventually. Now, it doesn't solve the other problem, which is the think tanks are, and this is true of Democratic think tanks too. Think tanks are funded by people who run the spectrum between libertarianism on the right and centrist neoliberalism on the left. I mean, that's it. There's no Bernie Sanders think tank. There's no Trumpism without Trump. There's American Compass, American Affairs, some other small, but, you know, disproportionately influential outlets. But I think that what that means is the Republicans are going to have to use the resources of government itself. If the only national institution you control is elected office, right? Then the parties are going to have to do the thinking. You can't expect grant-funded organizations raising money from billionaires to come up with something that billionaires don't like. And other parties in the Western world, the parties have their own party institutes, right? And they answer to the elected politicians and their voters. So now this may take some time. I'm surprised it has taken so long, frankly.
Mm-hmm. Michael, there's one point I want you to expand on a little bit, which for a more left-leaning audience, I don't think they intuit this as much. What you said is that the only debates in America which matter today are between mainstream Democrats, basically like centrist neoliberal Democrats, and progressives. Now, I think that conservatives, or many on the right, are beginning to understand that what they think is literally irrelevant. And then what they fight about amongst each other is even more irrelevant than that. And so when all is determined by that kind of internecine conflict within the liberal not even necessarily the coalition, between the liberal elites in terms of their discourse, what does that mean for our society? Just expand a little bit more on that.
Well, in the middle of the 20th century, a political scientist named Samuel Lubell came up with his sun and moon theory of the parties. That he argued that throughout American history, we usually have a one and a half party system. There's clearly a dominant party, and the essential debates take place within that dominant party. And it was the Lincoln Republicans up until the 1930s, and then it was the Roosevelt Democrats up until the 70s and 80s. And he called that the Sun Party. That's the Sun. The whole solar system revolves around it. Yes. The Moon Party has like the bright side of the moon and the dark side of the moon, and it splits into Me Too Sun Party people. Right. They just want the Sun Party policies watered down. Mm-hmm. And then on the dark side of the moon, as it were, they're just radical rejectionists. They're just against everything. Right. And I think that's a real danger, that the Democrats are becoming, you know, the de facto majority party. And if they win all of the elections except for the ones where you have rural overrepresentation in the Senate and maybe the Electoral College now and then, they're the majority party. And it's very difficult for the Moon Party, once it gets locked into that position, to progress, because there's this deep, deep division between the radical rejectionists who just want a total counter-revolution and the accommodationists who want to be accepted. You sort of saw this in the 50s and 60s. I mean, this is where Buckley, Goldwater, Reagan conservatism originated. As complete rejection of everything. The New Deal, the Civil Rights Revolution, they're just against everything. They became more moderate over time. And at the same time, they did criticize the so-called modern Republicans, like Eisenhower and others, of, you know, basically being watered down New Dealers. So it's not a good position to be in, you know, to be the satellite of the dominant party.
Mm-hmm. What I like about this is, like we mentioned at the top, we're recording pretty much a year to the date after our last episode. And at the time, speaking of ideas which have changed a bit, I was much more bullish on there's no libertarian path out for the party. Until, frankly, you had the lockdowns and the genuinely grassroots. Obviously, there was a lot of astroturfing, especially at the start. So that's the protests at the state capitol, all those dynamics. A lot of that was very cokey. But moving in, at least with my social media, and Sagar, I want you to speak to this too, because mm-hmm. you get this from listeners. There is a genuine small L libertarian. So not the DC beltway variety that we all have various degrees of beef with. But there's actual people who I know back home who are like, screw government. This isn't even about Dr. Fauci. This is like, why can the government tell me that I have to close my store or I can't keep my gym open? It's very folk. It's very grassroots, genuinely. And I just don't see that libertarianism having any interest in using government. It's just so the governing organs within the right are just so atrophied, and the top level philosophy is just so weak. And frankly, a huge problem is that all of the folks I see on the right attempting to provide a Trumpism after Trump or giving a framework are all mostly Ivy League people who, you know, have various degrees of inability to actually reckon with that reality. So I don't see the smart version of the anti-lockdown take who is going to disagree with me on a million different things, but at the end of the day, I know they're capable of providing a justifiable, suitable alternative. So how does that dynamic work? What I'm really getting at is, if you're coalition or you're part of the coalition has no control over the university system, popular culture, the think tank area, how do you actually create sustainable alternatives when you don't have the incentive to do so?
Well, I'm a professor and an author, and I've been accused of being an intellectual. I deny. But you can actually govern a country if most of the intellectuals are against you. And you just come up with policies among the politicians and community groups and so on. The intellectuals, for the most part, in the Roosevelt era, were either left-wing socialists who thought the New Dealers were pawns of the capitalists, or they were conservatives of various kinds. There weren't that many New Deal intellectuals. New Deal policy was hammered out by these, you know, many of them crooked Southern small-town politicians who got elected to Congress, you know, and you know, urban ethnic bosses like Carmine DeSapio. So there was no master plan that, you know, a bunch of intellectuals came up with in 1932 and implemented. And the plans they had, I've read them, were essentially tossed aside because they were so unworldly, you know, planning the economy and so on. If you look at the long hegemony of the Lincoln Republicans from the Civil War and Reconstruction all the way up until Herbert Hoover, the intellectuals hated them. They were seen as just, you know, a corrupt gang of protectionists, you know, representing manufacturing and they had some labor support and so on. They would engage in culture war issues, you know, refighting the Civil War, waving the bloody flag, as it was called. And they dominated the country in policy. So I guess I'm pushing back a little. I think that, and if you look at the libertarian think tanks, which, if I became a libertarian tomorrow, I could retire rich, right? I mean, there's so much money.
So could we.
We should start our own libertarian think tank. There's just so much money. But what have they accomplished? You know, in 30 years, there have been endless plans for privatizing Social Security. Toxic, dead on arrival, even when Republicans control all three branches, right? Open borders, not going to happen, right? You know, free trade, isolationism, not going to happen. I mean, you know, there'd be some, there's more liberal trade and less liberal trade. So I think you can overrate the importance of ideas as opposed to policies.
So thanks for the pushback, because I want to moderate what I said. I completely agree to the, you don't necessarily need intellectuals. I'm more speaking about the folks who run the technocracy. Sagar, this is your thing you always get really jazzed up about. But in many ways, the Trump administration was doomed the second that the travel ban was written in a terrible way and was just incoherent. The Trump administration in many ways was screwed when a lot of the only people they could hire were weird racist people who were then had to be publicly let go. And then that creates a vicious flywheel where, well, I don't want to work at DHS because there's that anti-Semite there, and it just goes on and on and on and on. So what I more mean is, it doesn't seem like the populist libertarian coalition that exists right now has the capacity to even put in place folks who have an interest in or ability to implement the policy points. Because you're totally right that the libertarian, all of the work of Cato Institute and the Mercatus Center has not been put to good use over the last 30 years. But I do believe if you did elect Justin Amash president, almost certainly I would trust them to implement all of the policies they want. I do not think the same thing is true of the populace, right? And guess what? The same is true on the populace left too. This is the general problem of populism. So what do you, now that I've redefined it, like, what do you think of the point there?
Well, if you're the more popular party that is frowned upon by business elites and universities and so on, the way the Democrats used to be, the way the Republicans are now, again, I think you have to use what you control, which is the government, so that you're not going to get a whole lot of, you know, let's say Trumpism without Trump, you know, whatever you want to call it, you know, more inclusive nationalist, less kooky, you know, program. You have to have cadres. You know, the plum book, the president appoints 4,000 some odd appointees, right? Well, where do they come from? Well, for the Democrats, since they now control the commanding heights of the corporations and of the media and of the universities, they have their pick and of the think tanks. The Republicans, I think, are going to have a narrower pool. It's got to be broader than Fox News, right? And QAnon or whatever. But there's still a pool there. And that pool is the congressional staff and also administrative agencies. So the real problem, I think, a lot of these problems with the Republicans could be fixed. If you had a sufficiently cohesive caucus in the U.S. Congress, and you had career paths for staffers, unfortunately, Senator Hawley seems to have damaged his career by, you know, endorsing these lies about the election being stolen. But, you know, people like that, you know, they're staffers. When you have a president of your party in the White House, you go to work in executive agencies. When you leave, probably for the foreseeable future, Republicans are not going to be that welcome, you know, at Uber and Lyft, you know, and at centrist think tanks and so on. But they could go back to work for the government. You know, in fact, if you look at the really transformative politicians, they were not outsiders. They were not amateurs who came in at the age of 60 or 70. I mean, Washington had a career in Virginia colonial politics. So Lincoln was a career politician. He practiced law. FDR, career politician, more or less. But you really need what the Soviets called the cadres. And so I'm agreeing with you, Marshall. That is, there were no cadres. In a sense, Trump was kind of premature. That's assuming he was trying to do something other than increase the value of his brand. It's not clear. But when Reagan came to power, you know, you had all of these people who could be appointed, and some of them were from business and think tanks. A lot of them were from the House and the Senate, and from congressional staffs and from state governments. So I think that's where you have to look for your farm team. It's the government itself.
That's really helpful. So as we are setting up the credibility and the work that you're doing, something a lot of our folks are thinking about is the future of both parties. And something you said specifically, you wrote a piece in, I believe it was May, you wrote a piece in early 2016 before the general election where you said the future of both parties are Clintonism and Trumpism, which you hear that and you think about what's focused on the Clintonian side. You hear that, you think that doesn't make any sense. That doesn't seem possible. But at the same time, Joe Biden won the nomination. Resoundingly so. Can you speak about how, in many ways, your conception of the idea that people were underrating the power of center-left post-Reagan neoliberalism as a political force? Can you just speak about that evolution over 4 years? Because the one thing that I don't think your piece anticipated was the rise of the Squad and the dynamic around that.
Well, that's right. The piece was back in 2015, I think, in Politico, where I argued that the Democrats had a Clintonian future, and the Republicans would be more populist and nationalist than necessarily, you know, resemble Trump in other ways. And that's just looking at their constituents. You know, the partisan realignment is nearing completion. It started back in the 60s and 70s when the Democrats started losing the white working class to the Republicans, and the Democrats started getting more and more upscale people. If you look at 1972, at the McGovern coalition, it was already foreshadowed what we have today. It was the top of the socioeconomic stratum and the bottom. So in a way, this is delayed Nixon-McGovernism, you know, that's now Clintonism-Trumpism or Bidenism-Trumpism. You know, I was surprised by the strength of the support for Bernie Sanders. But it turns out that the social base for that kind of left is inherently weak because it is largely people among, first of all, they're college educated young people for the most part, right? You know, these are not, you know, people who are, for one thing, they're working. I mean, they're not protesting in the streets, right? If you have a day job, you know, in an essential industry. So these are young college-educated, you know, would-be professionals. Many of them work in the universities and the nonprofit sector and so on. And I think, and it's true here, it's true in Britain, it's true in Western Europe, this is the social base for the so-called socialist left. But here's the problem with it, Marshall. Where do they get their money? Who pays their salaries? Billionaires! Billionaires pay their money through grants, either directly or indirectly through the Gates Foundation, through Bloomberg Philanthropies, and so on. So you know, it's kind of like what Herbert Marcuse, the Marxist, called artificial negativity, right? Where you have a bunch of people who depend on billionaires giving them grants, depending denouncing the billionaires. So I don't take it that seriously, you know.
Yeah, I completely agree with you, Michael. You're definitely just pissed off a part of our audience, and that's okay. It's when we try to articulate it. Look, I mean, it always has to be reconciled. It's like when you find yourself marching in the streets on the same side of Jeff Bezos, like, are you really reading A Populist Revolution? Go ahead and send me your hate mail. I've heard it all before. It's all good. There's something, though, that you said, which in the past, which I absolutely loved, and Marshall highlighted this, which is you said neoliberalism is the disease, populism is a symptom, and democratic pluralism is the cure. And one of the things I've always, always appreciated about your work is the advocacy for more democracy in order to solve the problems that we have. So look, we've just spent a lot of time outlining the partisan coalitions, obviously the problems of the technocratic neoliberal elite. That's, we've spent hours talking about that here. What do we do about it in the face of, you know, Trump's basic failures, you know, in terms of trying to do anything about it? Joe Biden just was overwhelmingly elected the president of the United States, at least 80 million votes. That's a lot of people, the most votes ever cast in American history. That is in its form a form of democratic pluralism. But if we're to order and reorder and try and fix our society, how are we to do it, Michael?
Well, I think the basis, and this is a project for a generation or several generations, is to rebuild grassroots mass membership organizations. And in the 20th century, the most important were local political machines. Up until the 70s, the parties were actually national federations of local clubs. That's disintegrated now. You know, they're labels that billionaires in New York, like Donald Trump and Michael Bloomberg, can compete for. So you had the local political machines, and sometimes they were corrupt, but they were in touch with the folks in the neighborhood. You had churches were much stronger, churches and synagogues in the middle of the 20th century. And then you had unions. And as I like to point out, the two most important civil rights leaders of the 20th century, A. Philip Randolph and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., were respectively a union founder and a pastor. So if you flash forward to 2020, we have this system in which the parties are really labels that groups of billionaire-funded politicians or self-financed politicians compete for. The intelligentsia, such as it is, and the media are owned or get grants from the same small group of billionaires. And for long-term secularization, I don't see this reversing. Fewer people, you know, are part of religious congregations. So the thing about the working class individuals have no power as individuals. They don't have, they have one vote, which doesn't count for much. They have no prestige. They have no contacts. They have no celebrity. If you're part of the working class majority of all races, native or immigrant, the only thing the working class has is its numbers. And those numbers are powerless unless they are organized in disciplined hierarchical organizations, not spontaneous mass rallies, where it's not these social movements like Occupy Wall Street or the Tea Party, a bunch of people milling around for a day or a week is carnival, right? It's like ancient Rome. It's like Latin American Catholic countries. You have carnival, you blow off some steam, and then you go back, you know, work for the boss. So I think in a way, the answer to what ails us politically is not going to be solved directly through the electoral political system. It's going to take institution building. And this country was good at that 100 years ago. You know, civil society, you know, the United Way, the farmers' lobbies, the Grange, the AFL, later the AFL-CIO, you know, the churches, the Catholic Legion of Decency. These were all grassroots organizations. And unless those exist, then politics is going to be a spectator sport where you have rich people and their agents battling it out while we watch on TV.
I'm so glad that you said that, Michael. I want to hammer this home because it's something that I actually basically stole it from you, and I've been emphasizing it ever since, is I'm like, what you just said requires and actually is, I wouldn't call it a libertarian solution, but it is a conservative solution in that what you just talked about are balancing forces which do not require the government, aka unions allow for collective bargaining in order to negotiate a wage without having to set something from the top. Churches and others being able to organize and put external pressure, you know, let for a lot of conservative grievance right now currently is like, well, nobody listens to us in Hollywood or elsewhere. As you pointed out in your book, they used to listen whenever it was an organized constituency which had real political power. But as you point to, in an increasingly secular world, and importantly, this is where the elite comes in, which is that Marshall mentioned the lockdown constituency. You have this genuine folk libertarian uprising against the lockdown. Here in DC, what does that translate to? And this is what I warned of here and elsewhere. It's Stephen Moore being like, see, we need to open the economy so we never have to spend a dollar in stimulus again because, and he said to this me, quote, government spending does not stimulate the economy. And you're like, this guy is out of his mind, but he is the representative functionally of the folk libertarian movement, half because his organization funded some of that, but also because he is the one in charge of translating that into a policy answer. So it seems like a two sides of the coin problem. So how do we create these institutions, you know, in especially if they are to be non-governmental as citizens? Like, what should civic-minded people who listen to this podcast do if they want to contribute to that?
Well, a few years ago, I was invited by a famous billionaire to spend a weekend in a castle outside of London with a bunch of other notables from around the world to come up with a new social contract for the Western world. And unfortunately, they didn't offer me plane fare. So I was tempted to send an email back saying, well, I'd like to come, but my private jet is in the, you know, getting its muffler fixed in the garage. And it's not going to come from plans. I mean, I co-founded a think tank. I mean, think tank, you know, are good for giving advice to politicians. But if you look at effective movements that changed American history, they started off in a particular place. The Republican Party started off in Ripon, Wisconsin. You know, there was the Free Soil Movement. There were the suffragettes. You know, there was the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, as the name suggests. It was Southern, right? There was the Grange and the Farmers Alliance started off in my native Texas and other places. So, you know, what I tell my students is, as a university professor, the first resort should not be a law passed by Congress or a presidential executive order. Like, maybe you should actually like knock on some doors of your neighbors and see if you can settle at the neighborhood level. And if that doesn't work, go up. Now, there's some things you can only do at the national level, but you have to have an army first, right? And there are two forces in politics. One is dollars. The other is people. And people power takes three forms. In the government, it takes the forms of votes or denying votes. In the economy, it takes the form of boycotts, or rather in culture. You can boycott movies you don't like. You can boycott TV shows. And in the economy, it takes the form of organized labor in some form. I'm sorry. Individual workers have no bargaining power if you're a janitor, you know, negotiating with Microsoft Corporation. It has to be organized countervailing power. Now note that the power of the organized working class is not intellectual. Okay, they're not making plans and things like that. There's a role for policy experts. They have veto power. If something is harming them, they can throw the switch and veto it. They can boycott the movie. You know, they can sit out the election. They can or vote for the other candidate. They can strike if they're organized. So power to the masses does not mean doing what public opinion says, but it means that they are able, you know, to put the brake on something that is affecting them in a bad way. Does that make sense?
Yes.
This is why I distinguish pluralism from populism. Populism says, okay, 51% of the people say this according to a poll, that should be policy. No, that's not the argument. I mean, you know, pluralism is, we have a community of communities. The nation is not just a community of individuals. These communities ought to be self-governing as much as possible. And you're absolutely right. Small government conservatives should embrace the pluralist vision, as well as civil libertarian progressives who don't want an overpowerful state. So ordinarily, the state should reign but not rule. It should let managers and employees cobble the details of health benefits and wages instead of trying to legislate everything from Congress. It should allow, you know, religious organizations, you know, and all secular organizations for that matter, ethnic organizations, to meet with media executives and say, hey, look, you're portraying our people in a demeaning, stereotypical way, right? Instead of the government, you know, trying to pass a law. So the government should only step in as a last resort. But notice the difference between pluralism of this sort and populism. Populism says there's this one guy, or maybe this one woman, mm-hmm. Who has this mystic affinity with me, you know, the little man, right, or woman who watches on TV. And I believe this one person is going to save us. And that always ends in tears. Pluralism, you have lots of intermediate authorities, each within their respective spheres. Okay. So maybe the Catholic clergy is upset with, you know, pornography in the media. Okay. And then they work on that. You have labor representatives, you have, you know, various kinds of industrial representatives, and they interact. And there's, so power is diffused through the whole system. So that kind of pluralistic diffusion of power, rather than concentration of power in the central government, particularly if the central government is captured by a small number of very well educated and very rich people, I think that's what we need to push for. And we need to be wary of the false alternative of populism, where some charismatic media star or tycoon, or Trump was both, is going to come in and parachute in and just save us, you know, because that's not the way the world works.
Mm-hmm. There's so much there, Mike. I want to hit a couple points. Number one, the perfect example of the operationalization of your pluralism idea is, look what happened with Pornhub and the credit card companies. What happened is, and this is the key thing about the pluralistic idea, you have to think of society as sectors. You had Nick Kristof, columnist at the New York Times. The New York Times is a institution. It's the, obviously it's not the paper of record it once was, but in the center left places that control our society in many respects, it's still taken as serious gospel. You had activists, some who are left and some who are right, who then had their work, and then that work was then amplified by the New York Times and Pornhub and all of the different companies that provide credit card services. Had to change everything within a week. Compare that to a conservative saying, we're going to appoint conservative senator to hold a couple hearings where we're going to yell at the Pornhub people and expect it to make any difference. That doesn't lead to any change whatsoever. Because once again, I'm not saying that if you're on the right and you dislike Pornhub, you have to say, I love the New York Times, they're my best friend. But you have to understand them as another power structure in society that in certain cases, you can actually form a coalition with to get things done. But I want to get to something that I think is going to serve as a barrier to people actually building these bigger institutions that on two different levels. So one, I'd like you to comment on this very, very, very annoying Occupy Wall Street, libertarian left in many ways idea that organizations don't have leaders. I mean, I remember with Occupy, the whole thing was, we don't have a leader. We don't have a representative. And if you look at BLM today, regardless of your feelings on BLM, BLM is an organization or a movement that doesn't have leadership. But I just saw today that it's been estimated that over the course of the last several months, hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, went to BLM organizations. It's completely unclear, and we'll find this for the show notes. This article is in the mainstream press. It's pretty unclear what all of that vast amount of money actually went towards. When there's no actual leader, when there's no actual institutions, it's impossible to actually hold anyone accountable. So I would just like you to comment on, and then one final thing here. I love your point about mass. I love your point about centralization, but we've had libertarians on this show. I'm thinking Barrick Torenberg, who are obsessed with the idea in the 21st century that everything is going to be about decentralization and getting nicher and nicher. Your goal was to get a small community of people who agree with you. Your goal is to get a newsletter where there are 1,000 people who pay you $100 a year instead of a mass market publication that doesn't pay you as good of a rate. So can you just comment on all these broad phenomena that I feel are going to serve as mental blockers to actually creating the institutions and giving people the conceptualization if we need to address these issues?
Yeah, let me begin by applauding your comments, Occupy style, by twinkling. Since clapping is too violent, so I'll twinkle. But let me start with the second point. Narrow casting and targeting and all of this. If what disproves that in politics is church buses, if you look at the late in the 1990s and the 2000s, who provided the muscle for the Republican Party and the Democratic Party? On the Republican Party, it was evangelical Protestants, who are a very small group of the population, and they're not actually a huge proportion of the electorate.
Right.
But they were hugely influential because church buses would bus people to the polls, get those physical bodies to the polls. And the African American church did it, and they're the reason Biden is president, mm-hmm. right? It was older church-going African-American Protestants. And if you don't physically bus them, you know, at least you get them to get out there and vote. You have voters' guides and things like that. So I think that the influence of the media, and I'm not saying you share this view, but I think it's overplayed. Most working-class Americans, and that's 3/4 of the population, are not that politically attentive. They get their news somewhat randomly, mostly from radio, TV. They're not heavily online. So there's a big difference between those who go to church and don't, and those who go to unions or don't, and the organizations can turn them out and have disproportionate political power. Now, remind me of your first question.
Oh, my first question was, many of these organizations have embraced many political movements, especially in the post-financial crisis space, have conceived of the idea that they shouldn't have leadership, they don't have leadership, it's all going to spontaneously gel into something coherent. That's why I refer to this idea as left libertarianism. I'm stealing that from Matt Stoller. But how do you respond to that conception? Because I feel as if that is what is going to stop everyone from doing things. The point about BLM is the fact that billions of dollars were given to BLM organizations. That's perfectly fine. But ultimately, there's not going to be any ability to cohere that into something sustainable or into something that people could be held accountable for in the way that centralized institutions that have leaders are actually able to have.
Well, I think that's the goal. If I'm writing the check for Citibank or Nike or whatever, I want to decapitate this potentially threatening movement by co-opting its most talented leaders, right? So they come up to me, you know, and say, I hate Citibank or, you know, whatever it is, down with finance capitalism. And we say, well, what do you say to, you know, a few million dollars, you know, for a nonprofit? And you'll be the president, right? And maybe we'll put you on a board, right? So I think a lot of this, part of these so-called social movements, I think are carnival, as I said. I think they're just like theatrical release of frustration for most of their followers. They're also recruiting tools for the national elite, right? And this is nothing new. Like if you look at, I spent a lot of time in the 90s with the people around the Clintons and Tony Blair and the third wave neoliberals. And if you looked at what they were doing in the 60s and 70s, they were radical Trotskyists. They were trying to overthrow capitalism. You know, now they were flying on private jets. They're on corporate boards. Mm-hmm. So to some degree, you know, this is, I think it's kind of elite co-optation. protest leaders. And it doesn't work with the right-wing version of this. So, for example, if you look at the anti-lockdown protests, these are largely small business owners, right? So what are you going to do? Like, you know, tell Joe the plumber? It's like, well, what if we give you money to start a small, socially impactful nonprofit, Joe the plumber? Yeah. He wants his plumbing business to survive, right? But it does work on the left of center, with essentially channeling a lot of people who would be on the outside, banging on the door, and then you bring them in.
Quick thing, Mike, not to interrupt. I just had a revelation with your framework. It seems to me you have two different power centers that are driving the dynamics here. So on the left, you have the broad nonprofit apparatus and the grantees, but on the right, you have the media. So from my perspective, the way that you would co-opt Joe the plumber, if Joe the plumber, this is a reference, especially to our Zoomer listeners, to a plumber who heckled, I think it was... McCain during the 2008 campaign. If Joe the plumber heckled a person today saying, I'm a small business owner and I'm getting screwed with these lockdowns, you know what you would do? They would offer him a Newsmax show and turn him into a useless culture warrior. That is the version of co-optation that goes there. Well, but that's obviously what you would do, right? You would say, look, Joe the plumber, oh yeah, the lockdowns are terrible. But you know what the real issue here? The real issue is that they're libs and libs are terrible and insert statement, and you give him a podcast, and probably he was actually not a bad performer.
It sort of sucks for
this is the last Joe the Plumber reference we'll probably make on the show, but it sucks for him personally that he came of age right before the boom of independent media and podcasting, so he didn't quite have the pivot opportunity. It's a real tragedy.
A point today. I made in a piece for a leftist magazine called The Bellows was I distinguished between the professional bourgeoisie, that is the college credential professionals who are afraid of being proletarianized, afraid of sinking in the working class. And they provide a lot of the muscle for the left and the Democratic Party. And then there's the small business bourgeoisie, the Joe the Plumber types, who are much of the muscle in the political base for the Republican Party. Now, the upshot of my analysis is these are still elites. The small business owners are a fairly small, but fairly affluent group compared to most of the public. So are, you know, people with PhDs working at Starbucks. They're still part of the social elite. We have not heard from the actual three quarters of the population that is working class, either last summer or, you know, left-wing, right-wing. Well, why? Because they're working. They're working. They can't fly across country to dress up in a Viking outfit and storm the Capitol, right? I mean, they can't go from city to city with their spray paint and their Antifa hooded outfits and all of this. As a friend of mine who was a 60s radical told me one time, he said, your mom and dad had to have a lot of money for you to take part in the Summer of Love. So, you know, the working class people, I don't think they're represented by small business owners. The actual number of people who own their own business in the U.S. I want to help them out if we can. It's less than 10% of the population.
Right.
Right. The number of people with a BA is about a third, even from a, you know, minor college or university. So what are these other folks doing? Well, they're working. They're working. They're not on TV. They're not engaged in these extra political spectacles. They're pretty much ignored by the two parties. And to me, that's the real tragedy of this.
Yeah.
And of our time in general, but of this time of plague in particular.
I think that's exactly right. It's funny. I'm thinking back when you're talking this way about the small business owners of, I remember Trump and a bunch of right-wing commentators trying to meme the idea that these like boat parades, these Trump boat parades were like this grand working class uprising. I'm like, no, it's not. I'm like, these are just these like small business owners who are actually like pretty wealthy and are culturally conservative and like didn't go to college. I'm not knocking it, but like, let's be honest, they'd be out there knocking doors for Romney. They were out there knocking doors for McCain, Bush, all of them. They're just like probably a little bit more obnoxious now that it's Trump. It's not a working class coalition, as you say, or not a working, it's not representative of the working class. As you point out, like working people are actually working. And so let's finish on this note, Michael, which is that if you actually want to see the working class in America have power, how does that come about in the near term? Or is it empirically just going to be a generational project of rebuilding non-governmental civic institutions and try to reorienting some of our civic life to have power once again in America?
Well, I think it's a generational project because, you know, you can have benevolent politicians who are backed by tycoons who have smart advisors, and you can come up with good policies for people, right? But it says, you know, like in, it says in the Bible, you know, and then there arose a Pharaoh who knew not Joseph. You get your good Pharaoh and then you get your bad Pharaoh. So, so unless you have your own army, you know, you're never quite safe. I think, and I was a real critic of the moral majority and Pat Robertson in the 1990s. But I think at this point in history, you're more likely to get faith-based organizations, churches and synagogues, maybe mosques and, I don't know, you know, Druid circles. You know, I'm open to this. I'm looking at this on socially.
Right.
They're more likely, they're kind of like the last mass membership institutions in American life. Now that about 6% of the private sector workforce is unionized, that's lower than it was under Herbert Hoover. And the political parties are gone as functioning, you know, knock on the door organizations. So curiously enough, I would not write off the churches and other religious institutions of other faiths because they have warm bodies every week and they have buses and they can get people to the polls. So it might not be the same form as the 90s, you know, evangelical religious right. And even if they're a minority, even though religion is declining, that's somewhat overstated because if you look at so-called secularization in the U.S., the decline is almost entirely among mainline Protestants. But you could argue that secular wokeness is, in fact, the highest stage of Methodism. I'm a Methodist, I would say this. It's, in fact, a form of mainline Protestantism. You know, but if you look at Catholics, if you look at evangelicals, they're fairly stable as a part of the population. And the other thing about the Christian church in particular is it's trans-ethnic and trans-racial. So to the extent that you do have a problem on the right of these white nationalist sectarians, you know, infiltrating it, it's not going to happen in the churches or the synagogues or the mosques for that matter. So warm bodies. You know, if you don't want government by dollars, then you need to have actual physical people whom you can deliver to the polls.
I think that's really well said. Michael, just a phenomenal return to the podcast. Thank you for joining us, sir.
Thanks,
Michael. All right, guys, thanks for listening to the episode. We really appreciate it. As always, do us a favor. Give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Hit subscribe at therealignment.substack.com for our newsletter.
And something we'd love for you all to do is send us your guest suggestions. As we mentioned at the start of the year, we are going to air more than 120-plus episodes a year. It is surprisingly difficult to book that many people off the top of our heads, so we 100% need your recommendations. And of course, last but not least, a huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. We are really excited with what's to come moving forward. See you next week.